Your Last Meal is sponsored by Heritage Distilling Company. Craft and small batch vodkas, gins, and whiskeys. Drink locally, drink responsibly.
Cairo, Seattle.
I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal, a show about famous people and the stories behind the foods they love most. Today on the program, the last meal of travel guru Rick Steves. Rick Steves has put out more than 50 European travel guidebooks. He hosts a public television show called Rick Steves Europe and a public radio show called Travel with Rick Steves. Boy, oh boy, does Rick like to travel. And despite being kind of a buttoned-up, detail-oriented guy, Rick has been a proponent for legalizing marijuana for a very long time. What is your favorite stoner snack?
I used to eat crackling oats without milk. I mean, the cereal crackling oats. I call them joy crunchies.
They look like little dog food pellets, but I love those too.
And I love them, and I would eat them one at a time as I was listening to my favorite music or whatever.
Rick and I both live in Washington State, where pot has been legal for several years now. And THC and CBD infused, every time I say this, THC and CBD, I feel like BBD, BBD, what was that song?
ABC, BBD.
Yeah. And then was that?
Motown Philly.
Oh, it's such a good song. Anyway, moving on. We have edibles in this state. They are infused with THC and CBD. You can listen to ABC and BBD while you eat them, but you can easily buy them at pot shops. So I chat with Jody Hall. She's the founder of Seattle Cupcake Empire, Cupcake Royale, and she has an edibles company called Good Chip.
One of the things that we work on at Good Chip is to kind of eradicate the notion of edible roulette. A lot of us have experienced an opportunity where we might have had a little bite or a rat's nibble or a whole brownie and not knowing what we're getting into. Are we getting into a margarita? Are we having a fifth of tequila? It's not a good feeling when you over-imbibe.
No, it's not. I recall, 2001 was the last time that I ate a pot brownie. I hallucinated, I was afraid of the dark, and ironically spent the rest of the night under the covers. And back to Rick Steves, it was actually tough to get Rick Steves to say what his last meal would be because he would rather let a chef of a restaurant cook whatever's in season and what's delicious that day instead of choosing something himself. I had to ask him 3 times to really focus and tell me what he wanted for his last meal. So we're going to hear from my colleague, Cairo radio host John Curley, about his 2017 New Year's resolution to never open a menu and order based on what the server says is the most popular item on the menu.
What do most people order? Yeah, most people get the rack of lamb. I'm like, it's $47. Really, most people get the rack of lamb? Well, you ask what most people get, they get the rack of lamb. So then I'd get the rack of lamb. I ate more racks of lamb than I've ever eaten before. 2017 turned out to be the New Year's resolution, eat more racks of lamb.
And in Your Last Meal news, yes, we have news, a really sweet thing happened recently. Literally, a very sweet thing. Back in December, I had Top Chef judge and Food & Wine magazine editor Gail Simmons on the program, and her last meal was banoffee pie.
Banoffee pie is a British dessert. It is a banana, cream, and dulce de leche pie.
Well, there's an ice cream company in Seattle called Sweet Lowe's Homemade Ice Cream. You may remember them. I had the owner, Lauren Wilson, on for my Darcy Carden episode. That's when we were talking about why marshmallows don't freeze in Rocky Road ice cream. So Lauren is a fan of the podcast. There she was listening to the Gail Simmons episode. I like to think she was like laying on a bed with a canopy on top and like talking on her pink princess phone to her other friends listening to the podcast as well. And she heard Gail Simmons say that she loved banoffee pie. So Lauren was inspired to create a banoffee pie ice cream flavor. Roasted banana ice cream, homemade dulce de leche, candied graham crackers, and milk and dark chocolate flakes. So she makes this ice cream, she packages it up, and then she sends 6 pints of it to Gail Simmons, I think in New York City. Gail receives the ice cream, tries it, loves it, ends up tweeting about it, Instagramming about it, tells the world that she loves it. Lauren has the best day of her life. I'm excited. It's a complete full circle experience. So I thought that was pretty fun. And if you want to follow the action on social media, you can follow me at I'm Rachel Bell. That's on Twitter. I'm Bell with an E. And that concludes your Last Meal news. All right, let's get into the episode with Rick Steves. So your new book is called Travel as a Political Act, How to Leave Your Baggage Behind. Can you explain the concept of your new book? This is not your typical, you know, pick a city in Europe guidebook.
Right. Yeah, well, people who know me from decades of teaching European travel. And I've been teaching enthusiastically and tirelessly here in the Seattle area since the 80s. And if I look back on it, I didn't have any grand plan, but there's been sort of a logical evolution. In the 80s, I was talking about, you know, Europe through the back door. That was the book. And it was budget skills, how to use a train pass, how to get a good hotel, how to pack light and stay healthy and so on. And then in the 90s, it occurred to me, okay, you know, we've cut the train. We know how to pack and find a hotel. That's the bottom rung of Maslow's hierarchy of travel needs, you could say. The next step up would be enjoying the culture and the history and the art and the cuisine. And I wrote a book called Europe 101, and I was enthusiastically teaching classes about appreciating the culture and the art. And then since 9/11, I've realized that the pinnacle of this, what I consider Maslow's hierarchy of travel needs, is to travel in a way where you get out of your comfort zone and you mess up your wallop, your ethnocentrism. You gain an empathy for the other 96% of humanity, and you come home with what I think is the most beautiful souvenir, and that's a broader perspective. So that's what I find myself teaching. Tomorrow I'm going to go embark on a 25-city and 30-day road trip around the United States, and almost every night I'm going to be talking to big crowds about travel as a political act. And the whole idea is, again, to challenge Americans to get out of their comfort zone and to gain a better understanding of the rest of the world, because it's more important than ever right now that the United States gets itself in a mindset where we're more inclined to build bridges and less inclined to build walls. And I think that's important from a national security point of view, by the way, too. The most dangerous thing we can do is stay home and hide under a bed and build walls. We've got to play ball with the rest of the world, and we can do it as travelers. I love to go to places where we're not supposed to go. I've been recently to Iran and Cuba and Palestine. I want to stress I've never gone any place where I thought was risky or dangerous.
Yeah, my dad is from Israel, so I've been a few times, and I went for the first time when I was 9. So my perspective has always been how good the food is and how much fun I had with the people there and like these beautiful sights I saw. And as I got older, I realized, oh, most people don't see Israel in that way. They see it as a war zone. And people would often ask, you know, why would you go? Don't you feel like, you know, you'd be nervous you're going to get bombed? And it's like, but all those people live there every day, and they go to work, and they go out dancing, and they date, and they just live their life, because you can't just stay home, you know? So that was kind of interesting to me, and I'm sure there's a lot of countries like that where there are amazing things to visit, but we have this taboo or just like a narrow-mindedness that it only is a dangerous place.
You know, you're so right, Rachel, and a lot of Americans we're confusing fear and risk. Fear is an emotional thing. And okay, you can be afraid. It's emotional. That's what terrorists are trying to do, is they're trying to make us afraid. Risk is a statistical thing. What is the risk? Every year, 12 million Americans go to Europe and 12 million come home. I don't know when the last American was killed by a terrorist in Europe. Maybe a couple a year. Does that make it dangerous? Well, look at it from a statistical point of view. Every year, every month, 1,000 people are killed on our streets in homicides with guns. Does that make America dangerous? Well, no, it doesn't. I still go shopping. I still go downtown. Use some common sense. But there is a risk. People used to say bon voyage, and now people say have a safe trip. I don't know where this came from, but when somebody tells me to have a safe trip, I'm inclined to say, well, you have a safe stay at home, because where I'm going is statistically, and I know statistics are optional these days, but statistically where I'm going is safer than where you're staying. In fact, if you knew the statistics and you loved your children, you would take them to Europe tomorrow, because you're living in a very dangerous part of this world here in the USA.
What is your favorite country in the world for eating, or favorite city?
That's a fun question. I think Japan's my favorite country in the world for eating. I just love eating in Japan. And in Europe, I love working on the restaurant sections in all my guidebooks. And every night I'm out blitzing all the restaurants. And at the end of a long night of looking at restaurants, checking the restaurants already in my book and looking up new ones, I sit down in my favorite new restaurant of the evening. And I love to just ask the chef to bring me whatever he wants me to eat. My favorite countries in Europe for food would be Italy and France, no surprise. One thing I think is very important, if you are a good eater going to a good restaurant, in Europe anyways, you can look at the menu and you can know where you are and what month it is by what's being served. And that's the whole idea of eating with the seasons and eating local specialties. That's why I like to look at what's the daily specials and so on. That's where you'll have, oh, the porcini mushrooms are in season, so everybody's into that right now, or the white asparagus, and everybody's into that. Eat what the locals are eating. Eat with the season. Eat in a small mom-and-pop restaurant. Another very important tip is to go to a restaurant that is a low-rent place, not on Piazza Navona where the high rent is and all the tourists are, but in a little hole-in-the-wall place a few blocks away, which is low rent, packed with enthusiastic local eaters with a handwritten, small, one-language menu. Handwritten because it changes with what's ever fresh in the market this week. Small because they're only cooking up what they can serve profitably and at a good value. And one language because they're targeting local eaters rather than tourists.
Sometimes that's hard, though. When I was in Venice, we literally walked for hours trying to get away from the same tourist menus. Walking and walking, we finally found a place because I'm looking exactly for what you're talking about. But I find it to be a little challenging. I had the same experience in Lisbon where I was like, oh, my God, I just want to get out of here. I want to go to where the locals are eating.
Well, Venice, Rachel, is impossible because Venice is completely a tourist town. So there's no restaurant in Venice, I don't think, that could live without tourism. And what I would resort to there is the local tapas culture. It's called
Cicchetti.
I love it. And then you just go to a series of local bars and you eat ugly things on toothpicks and you wash it down with local wine. And it's one of those mobile meals. You'll go to three places in an evening and you'll eat all sorts of adventurous food. You'll talk to new friends at the bar. You won't spend very much money and you'll be eating the local cuisine.
Yes, I had this experience that Rick talks about when I was in Venice. I would order vegetable, whatever the vegetable was that night to go with my meal. And it was always the same thing. It was summer. So it was eggplant and zucchini. And I imagine if we were there in the spring, it would have been like squash blossoms. So you kind of have no choice but to eat in season when you're in some of these places. Rick, what is your last meal? What would you choose?
My last meal. Oh, man. My last meal. That's such a funny question. I don't know what I would choose. I'm not that big of a foodie where I'd be concerned about my last meal if I was about to die. But if I had to answer that question, I think it might be, there's a little Enoteca in Verona, Enoteca Can Grande, run by just a delightful husband and wife. And I love to step in there late at night and say, bring me whatever you like. And they bring me a beautiful bottle of amaretto, and they bring me gorgeous, sort of a montage of antipasti and beautiful, beautiful homemade pasta. And then there's all of these different fire waters that come out after the meal's over. And I've made friends with the people at the little tables around me. And before I know it, I've been there for 5 hours, and then I have to die.
What's a fire water?
Fire water would be the local grappa or the local aquavit. It's a beautiful dimension of travel. I'm not into hard liquor here, but as I travel, I'm a cultural chameleon. You know, I never work hard all day long in Seattle and go home and feel like a nice glass of ouzo. But when I'm in Greece, I love to end the day with a nice glass of ouzo as the sun is setting. Tea makes no sense at all to me in this hemisphere. But when I'm in England, a nice shot of tea or a nice spot of tea is really good. I was thinking shot of tea because north of England in Scotland, I drink whiskey. I never drink whiskey in Seattle. But when I'm in Scotland, I actually buy a small bottle of whiskey and I travel with it and I have a dram every night. And it just helps me feel like I'm in Scotland. And it's a real joy.
I absolutely love that Rick lets the restaurant choose his dinner. And I'm sure it's delicious. But in order for this show to work the way that it does, I needed Rick to tell me a specific food. Like, what kind of antipasta do you want? What kind of pasta do you want? I'm trying to put a show together here, Rick. You understand that. You have a TV show. You have a radio show. So I pressed him for specifics. And then I pressed him again.
It would be the bruschetta with the beautiful olive oil and the variety of toppings. It would be the local pasta with whatever topping that he liked. And I think it would be zucchini flowers. That would be really nice if they were in season. It wouldn't be fancy food. It would be local food. It would be in-season food. And it would be served by somebody who really knew the beauty of, you reach the culture through the hearth. But that's what I would say.
All right. Still not terribly specific, but Rick has made his point. He is happy to eat whatever is in season, whatever is regional, and whatever the cook thinks that they can cook best that day, which really is the best way to go. You can't argue with that. But I personally cannot do this. I have some kind of weird control thing where I really want to select what I'm going to eat. It takes me forever to order. I am kind of annoying to go out to dinner with sometimes. and I feel like if I were to let the server choose for me, giving up that control would actually be really good for me in general. I think psychologically it would release a lot.
Yeah, we're the opposite here.
Really?
I get paralyzed by choice.
Oh.
I kind of like everything. It all sounds good. So if I can remove that responsibility from the equation, I am a happy camper.
So if you let the server decide what you were going to eat and then it came and you didn't like it, would you feel resentful towards that person?
No, I would be mad at myself for not explaining like, hey, I don't really like, you know, shellfish, let's say. And then they bring me a bunch of shrimps, I'd be like, well,
shrimps.
I probably should have said something.
Well, my colleague, our colleague, you're hearing Aaron Mason's voice, the producer of the show, Cairo radio talk show host John Curley, he ate, I guess what we could call the Rick Steves method for an entire year. For one whole year, he never chose what he wanted out of a menu at a restaurant. And we will hear from him when Your Last Meal returns right after this. It is cocktail hour with our one and only sponsor, Heritage Distilling Company. And you just heard Rick Steves talking about how when he is in a country, he likes to drink their local spirits. He doesn't drink grappa at home, but when he's in Italy, he's drinking grappa. So when you are in the United States of America, you should be drinking Heritage Distilling Company. And if you live in Washington State, it becomes even more local. Heritage Distilling Company uses corn and wheat from Eastern Washington family farms like Scrupps in Odessa, and the rye that they use in their bottles of dual barrel old fashioned ready rye comes from Vancouver, Washington. So go to heritagedistilling.com to find out where you can get a bottle of award-winning vodka, gin, whiskey, or brown sugar bourbon. It's sold in stores around the country, or you can have a bottle delivered right to your door. That's heritagedistilling.com. I have a reputation for taking forever to order at a restaurant. I hem and haw over a menu. I'm trying to figure out exactly what I'm in the mood for at that very moment. And I've also been known, I haven't done this as much as I used to run back into the kitchen like 2 minutes after I order.
What?
And I'm like, I changed my mind. Can I actually have the burger? Is it too late? And sometimes it's too late and other times it's not. And they probably spit in my food. And then sometimes when that arrives, I'm like, should have got the other thing. So want to go out to eat with me? It's fun. Promise we're going to have a good time. But my colleague, Cairo talk show host John Curley, has no such worries. All right, John Curley. So every year you do a New Year's resolution.
Yes.
Ranging from things like not wearing socks.
Not wearing underwear.
Okay.
Wearing new socks, introducing myself to whoever's on an elevator, not recognizing Hawaii as the 50th state. And then I developed the theme. 2016, as you may recall, was order the soup of the day no matter what it is.
That was 2016.
2016. So 2017, I continued on that theme, but was to never look at a menu.
Okay. So how did you accomplish this goal?
Simply by not looking at a menu.
This is my show. You're going to talk to me like that. Okay, so what you would do is you'd go to a restaurant,
right,
and then the server comes over and says, oh, what can I get for you, sir?
Do you need a few more minutes to look at the menu? And I'd say, no, it's 2017. I'm not looking at menus. And then they just sort of stand there. And then I say, what do most people order? And she's like, a lot of people get the tacos. And I'm like, great, have the tacos. Or she'd be like, and she looks at the menu, and this is when these waitresses or waiters started to figure it out. What do most people order? Yeah, most people get the rack of lamb. I'm like, it's $47. Really? Most people get the rack of lamb? Well, you ask what most people get, they get the rack of lamb. So then I'd get the rack of lamb. I ate more racks of lamb than I've ever eaten before. 2017 turned out to be the New Year's resolution, eat more racks of lamb.
Yeah, more rack than you'd ever seen. Okay, so for 1 year, how often do you go out to eat? Like, how many meals were you not choosing for yourself on average?
Three a week.
Okay.
Three or four a week, yeah.
And did you ever have anything that you really didn't like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of times I'm like, really? This is what people order? And the one lady goes, most people that come in here are pretty poor. I'm like, huh.
Where okay. was that?
It was a restaurant up on Capitol Hill. It was a Mexican restaurant, and it was terrible. It was this soup and this little crappy taco. Not good. But most of the time, what I found was people have pretty good taste in food.
How often, then, do you think that they were telling you the truth, and how often do you think they were just
trying to give you the most expensive thing on the menu?
I think most of the time, probably 8 out of 10 times, they were legitimately answering the question, what do most people order? But as you pointed out, you said the only way this works is you have to walk into the restaurant with absolutely no regard for what you want. You can't walk in going, gosh, I really feel like Crab Louie today. You have to just simply, you know, splay yourself out there and be able to go with whichever everybody wants.
Well, it should be pointed out that you're the only person that I know, maybe who I've ever met, who really doesn't care about food. You eat food exclusively for fuel.
True.
So I think that this resolution was probably easier for you than anyone else, because this to me sounds like hell. I have tried to do this since you've mentioned it.
Yes.
I haven't done it once.
Yeah.
I'll sit there and I'll go, okay, today's the day. No, I just want to order my own thing. And I think that it's a control issue. And I think that if I actually gave up just this little bit of control, it would actually make me a better person.
The thing is, you like food. I don't like food. I remember one time I went in and ordered a Subway sandwich with a friend of mine, and he ordered the turkey and I ordered the tuna. I picked up his turkey and ate almost all of it. And then he said, hey, this is, you ordered tuna. And I said, isn't this tuna? He goes, it's turkey.
It's so you don't even know what food is.
I don't even know what I mean. I would eat rocks if my teeth could up to withhold the pressure.
What do you think that is? Do you have different taste buds than the average person, or is it a mental thing?
I'm Irish.
Okay.
I'm Irish, and my mom was a horrible cook and burned a lot of things and then just said, shut up and eat it. So then we just got used to eating really crappy food.
So didn't you tell me, though, that sometimes they would kind of get irritated with you? Like, they didn't want to have to pick your meal?
Yeah, they didn't. They would give me, like, a bunch of choices, and then they'd say, you know, you could just check the menu. And I'd say, no, I never, literally, it is a freeing experience, like jumping out of an airplane without a parachute. When you don't look at the menu, you don't need to look through it. And when they come by and they start to tell you about the specials, you just say, no, I don't need to know the specials. I just need to know what everybody else orders. And that normally the person sitting across from me is like, you are the most annoying person in the world.
Which seems like it would be the opposite, because I can be a little When Harry Met Sally, and I'm like, okay, I want this, but can you not put it with this? And how about this? And like, it seems like you'd be a dream, because then it'd just be like, you're in and you're out.
Whatever. That's right. Eat it. Be done.
I had a boyfriend who had pretty bad ADD, and he had a pile of shirts, and he would just wear whichever one was on top.
Yeah.
And I noticed when we'd go out to eat, it took me a while to notice it. I was like, you always order one of the first three things on the menu.
There you go.
He's like, I can't read the whole thing. I just get to that, I get bored, and I order something in the top three.
Here's one habit that I have developed that I still keep doing that really grosses people out. If the food is too hot, I pour water on it.
Well, you're not supposed to do that. No, you don't.
Yes, I do. Because I don't have time to wait for it to cool off. And I don't want to be blowing on it. I just take whatever it is. If the soup's too hot or the water's too hot, whatever liquid I have nearby, and just pour it on top. Pour it on top of the chicken. Pour it on top. It works. That's why they shoot water at fires. It has the same effect.
So did you have any kind of, were you able to give up control? Like, did this help you not having to pick something on the menu? I mean, did this like save you time in your life? Did it make you feel better that you don't have to make a decision? Like, was this a New Year's resolution that actually benefited you?
This benefited me that I felt closer to the appetizers and to the entrees of the general public. And I think that's what we're all striving for. I think Buddha mentioned that.
Dolly.
Dalai Lama.
Dolly Parton again.
Dolly Buddha.
Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned Wreck of Lamb, but yes. What are some other dishes that you found yourself eating a lot? Were there trends?
Is there a reoccurring theme? Yeah, sure. Let's talk a little bit about the Turkey Club, which is apparently very popular because it has bacon on it. I didn't taste any bacon, but then again, I really wasn't into the whole idea of tasting the food. Gyros, surprising me. A lot of people like gyros. You go into a Greek restaurant and there's gyros out the door. So I got the gyro. I got this is during lunch. Dinner, it ran the gamut. A lot of chicken. People are eating a lot of chicken nowadays. I noticed that. And a lot of king salmon, too. They seem to like that.
Probably because we're here in Seattle.
That's probably it.
Also, along the lines of your weird food eating habits, you ate peanut butter and jelly sandwiches peanut butter and honey sandwiches 3 times a day for many months here.
5 times a day. I would bring in 5 peanut butter and honey sandwiches and eat only that for 3 months. And no dinner. That's all I would eat. And then finally, because I wanted to know, could I eat peanut butter and honey sandwiches 5 times a day for an entire year? And the answer is no.
You could do it for 3 months.
3 months, and then it has an effect upon your colon.
Did any server ever recommend a peanut butter and jelly sandwich when you were out? You were like, no! And you just punched him in the face and run out of the restaurant. There he goes, everybody. Mr. John Curley. I am still tempted to try this at one point. Like, I need to at least just do it once. I feel like maybe it's not the best route to go with what is the most commonly ordered menu item.
Yeah.
Because then you're eating what, you know, the peasants are eating, the little people. I want to know what the chef's favorite thing is on the menu, and I will eat that.
I can only imagine, like, food is like it is in television, where the most popular thing isn't necessarily the best thing.
Yeah. That's why I don't like Yelp, because I don't know who these people are. You know, it's like they could be Taco Bell 364 days a year, and then one day they go out to a nice restaurant and they're like, I didn't like it. There wasn't a view.
They didn't have chalupas.
Right. All of a sudden, it's 3 stars. I can't trust these people. But speaking of people you can trust, Heritage Distilling Company, they're a sponsor of our show. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Seamless.
Yeah. It is cocktail hour here at Your Last Meal with our sponsor, Heritage Distilling Company. And if you've ever had a conversation with me, you know that I love wordplay and puns. So I was very impressed when Justin Stiefel, the owner and founder of Heritage Distilling Company, came up with this sweet slogan: you can't spell baseball without BSB. He's talking about their brown sugar bourbon, and Heritage Distilling Company is a proud sponsor of the Seattle baseball team, of which we cannot name for legal reasons. You can figure it out. The important thing is you can't spell baseball without BSB. And honestly, drinking is the only reason I go to baseball games. I'm not a sports person, but I love sitting in the stadium, looking up at a blue sky, looking down at the green field, eating a hot dog, and having a nice drink. So you can drink Heritage Distilling Company at the ballpark in Seattle, or you can make your own nice drink at home. Go to heritagedistilling.com to find out where you can get a bottle of their vodka, gin, whiskey, or brown sugar bourbon. You can find a supermarket near you that sells Heritage, or have a bottle delivered right to your door. Hey, we're back with travel expert Rick Steves. So you've been an advocate of legalizing marijuana for many years. I think I interviewed you probably like 8 years ago or something about this, long before it became legal in Washington. I think a lot of people now are learning that, you know, there are not these like stoner stereotypes attached where it's like someone sitting on the couch all day eating Cheetos. A lot of people smoke weed and it's fine. But I do have to ask, what is your favorite stoner snack? Like, if you're smoking pot, what do you crave? What do you like to eat?
I used to eat crackling oats without milk. I mean, the cereal crackling oats. I called them joy crunchies.
They look like little dog food pellets, but I love those too.
And I would just, I love them, and I would eat them one at a time as I was listening to my favorite music or whatever. But we've come a long way since we legalized marijuana in Washington 5 years ago. I go on the road all the time. Next week, I'll be in Washington, D.C., and Delaware, and Vermont, and New Jersey on a busy road trip raising awareness about the tragedy of our federal war on marijuana. And it's not pro-pot. I'm pro-civil liberties. I'm pro-smart policy. I'm anti-racism. We have racist laws right now. Rich white guys don't get busted for pot. It's poor people, and black people get busted for pot. It's an embarrassing, horrible thing in our country. 70,000 Americans are in jail right now because of nonviolent marijuana offenses. We arrest 600,000 or 700,000 people a year in this country for pot. And what seems like common sense, that's wrong. I mean, people think if you legalize marijuana, more people are going to smoke it. Well, I've learned, and my European friends have taught me, there's no correlation between how strict the laws are and how much is consumed. You know, this is not a reservoir of decent people that would love to ruin their lives smoking pot if only it was legal. Anybody who wants to smoke pot does. You know, marijuana is a drug. It's, I'm not saying it's healthy for you. It's not healthy for you. It's just fun, and some people want to do it. And that's a civil liberty.
So Rick is talking about serious stuff here. He's doing amazing work in the world of marijuana, but I'm going to lighten things up a little bit. We're going to talk about edibles, aka foods that get you high. So when I was a kid, there was no word edibles. Basically, the words were pot brownies. And this was made with pot butter, and you had no idea how strong these things were going to be. So you would be like, I don't know, should I take one bite? Should I eat the whole brownie? I have no idea. And it takes so long for it to kick in that you don't want to wait and then, you know, eat a little bit more. So sometimes I remember, like, you'd eat like two because you're like, these are really good. And you forget that they're full of weed. And then you have to lay down on the ground for the rest of the night and, like, listen to Beavis and Butthead coming out of the TV. And I bring that up because Erin Mason and I watched a ton of Beavis and Butthead over the weekend.
Dude.
Oh, so good. All those music videos. But today, in states where pot is legal, like here in Washington where we live, you can actually walk into a store and buy what is called edibles. And these are professionally packaged sweets. They're made by companies that know exactly how much pot is inside. And they range from cookies to brownies to gummies to little mints. And here in Seattle, we even have, there might be more than one of these now. There's an Airbnb in Seattle that is weed themed. So like there's bongs in all the rooms, but you can pay extra to have a chef come to the house and make you a multiple course meal where every part of the meal is infused with weed.
Really?
Yeah. And because I think this is a great idea because why is it always in sweets? You can add, you know, the butter or the oil to anything really. But most of the edibles out there are sweet, including those made by Seattle's The Good Chip Company. Owned by Jody Hall. So after many years of working at Starbucks as a barista and then moving on to doing Starbucks corporate, this is like kind of the early years of Starbucks, Jody left and she started a company in Seattle called Cupcake Royale in 2003. And now, you know, you hear, oh, cupcakes, cupcakes are everywhere. Cupcake Royale was actually the first cupcake bakery to open outside of Manhattan. Were you a baker? Did you have this recipe you were sitting on? Where did the cupcake idea come from?
No, I'm not a baker at all, but I'm really good at having an idea and finding people that can help do the things that I don't know how to do. At the time, I knew how to build a retail company. I knew how to manage production of a product, and I needed a baker. So I hired a baker.
And Jody applied the same strategy when she opened Good Chip.
Good Chip is a manufacturer of edible products, super delicious edible products. We have cookies from our bestseller Saigon Snickerdoodle cookie to a sea salt chocolate chip, double fudge brownies, etc. We have chocolate products, so dark chocolate with coffee or straight up dark chocolate or dreamy milk. We have confection products such as our pastilles, which are microdose to 2.5 milligrams. And those look like Altoids or, you know, like little mints that you would get. We just recently in the last 3-4 months launched half dose products. We launched a fruit jelly, which is a proper French pâte de fruits. It's the predecessor to what we call gummies in America, but really good fruit juice, apple pectin, organic sugar. That's what's in that. We also have a peppermint patty that's an organic chocolate coating. It's super delicious. Again, 5 milligrams THC. Some of those products have a CBD version as well.
So CBD is a cannabis compound that doesn't actually get you high, but it has all the medical benefits of marijuana. The last time that I ate pot, I was 21 and I became afraid of the dark and like had to go back to this cabin we were staying at and just like lay in the bed. And I was totally freaked out. I never ate it since. I'm sure you hear a lot of stories like
this. Edible roulette thing that we're trying to combat. Yes.
Exactly. So that's what I think is amazing about the legalization and then having mm-hmm. these edible products is that they are regulated. How do you do that? How does it mm-hmm. work when, you know, you're making these items? How do you know how much to put in?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's important. We understand exactly how much THC is in that product. And we do math and we figure out our batch size. We've gone through multiple iterations to make sure that that THC is uniformly homogenized throughout the entire batch. That's just a baking 101 in a lot of ways. So yeah, we do math and we test the final result and make sure it's right on point. And then we package it up and sell it out to our stores. Part of why I want to do this as well is to build a consistent experience, to build a trusted experience. It's just like if you have a Budweiser here and you go to Colorado and have a Budweiser or Europe, you want it to be the same experience.
And I hope you're not having a Budweiser in Europe, though.
No, I hope not. Yeah. I don't know why I said that.
Just the fine beers of Europe.
A fine Stella instead.
That's right. So, okay, as a consumer, though, how do you know how much you can take? Because let's say there's, you know, a cookie and it has 5 milligrams. I'm assuming there's a difference if you're a 90-pound woman or if you're a 200-pound man, how it's going to affect you. How do you know how much you're supposed to eat?
Right. That's something that everybody needs to figure out on their own. Because
by being afraid of the dark one night?
No, by starting slow. And I would really recommend that if you buy a Good Chip product, we do have the pastilles or we have the 5 milligram product. You could cut the 5 milligram in half. 2.5 milligrams will mostly affect most people on a really light level. That's a really good starting spot. And if that doesn't give you an effect, and of course it can take you know, as little as 30 minutes. It can take an hour and a half or even 2 hours for it to kick in. And that depends on what is your mental state like? How hydrated are you? Did you just eat a big meal or not? All these factors might change from time to time, but eventually you kind of get a sense. So I know that I love 2.5 milligrams. I can totally do 5 milligrams. If I'm talking to folks, and 2.5 to 5 is generally fine for me, but more than that, I want to be at home watching a funny movie or not really have any responsibilities beyond that. And everybody has to kind of figure that out for themselves. And for example, I know a fellow I was working with who really never consumed marijuana his whole life. I think he's 45, probably weighs 150 pounds, a lean, skinny guy. He would have to eat 3 cookies to feel it. Huh. 30 milligrams.
Whoa.
Where that would just knock me over.
So how do you incorporate the pot or THC into the food? Because anyone, you know, who's experimented before, it would always go into the butter or mm-hmm. oil is what I understood.
So there's various methods to extract THC or oil from the cannabis plant. You could use ethanol extraction. You could use CO2. You could use hydrocarbon, which is butane hash oil. And we're all learning this, right? This is all kind of newer technology that's now out in the light. We actually buy the oil. We're not growing marijuana and extracting marijuana.
So you're not throwing chunks of weed into a vat of butter.
We're letting the growers help make that for us. That keeps it clean and green is really important to us. We don't want pesticides. And so we have very stringent specs on what we're looking for. We don't look for a very high chloroform taste, plant weedy taste. We distill it to kind of weed that out, literally.
And that was Rick Steves' last meal.
I'm so lucky that I found my niche, and it's my passion, it's my hobby, and it's my work. It's traveling.
The third edition of Rick Steves' book, Travel as a Political Act, is out now. You can find that book along with all of his guidebooks and lots of other stuff at ricksteves.com. He also has this big travel company, and you can take a tour, and all that's available at ricksteves.com.
I've actually read Travel as a Political Act.
Oh, you have?
Before, yeah, years ago, and it's a great book.
Cool.
Yeah.
And now in its third edition. Thanks to John Curley, a lovable little weirdo who sits across from me at work every day, and he makes me laugh. And he's also a very successful, fast-talking auctioneer. I feel like I said that too slow. He's also a very successful fast-talking auctioneer if you need such a service. And he's on the Tom and Curley Show on Cairo Radio. If you live in the area, you can listen on 97.3 FM or online at mynorthwest.com. Thanks to Jody Hall, founder of Cupcake Royale and The Good Ship Company. You can find more at thegoodship.com. And Jody says they're in the process of building a second production site in California so that they can sell their edibles there as well. And if you're in Seattle, she organizes this really cool event called Higher Education. It's a super interesting lecture series that you're supposed to attend while high, so you can ponder concepts like astronomy and sexuality with expert lecturers from around the country. If you like this show, which if you made it this far, I would hope so, give us a little love on the old iTunes. Can you give a review at Android?
Yeah, sure.
Is there such a thing as at Android? Just leave a review. It really does help. It also helps my self-esteem. I read them. It makes me feel good about myself. I need that. I have dad issues. Help. This episode is produced by Aaron Mason and me. Our theme music is by Prom Queen. I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal.